final part of this message that I've been working on for 3 weeks now. And this is the one that's going to, I'm going to tell you, this is either going to draw you in or drive you out or you're dead. So just check. Are you breathing? Good. This is either going to draw you in or drive you out. There will be people who decide, man, I don't want to do that. But you'll know it's a decision. And I don't want to just blah, 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 blah. I don't need to just fill my time with talk. I love action. This past week's readings were so encouraging. Reading from Daniel. In one of the toughest times of the story of Israel and Judah, where God drives them out of his land, there is this, you know, you sense almost this frustration, but this righteous anger in God. That he goes, man, you just talk. You say you're going to honor me. You say you're going to do this, but you just do whatever you want. And he says, get out. He drives him out of his city. He drives him out of his land. He allows the temple to just be, you know, torn down. But the thing is that Daniel and these other captives are taken from the kingdom of Judah into Babylon. And Babylon is a hardcore pagan nation. But the thing is that David and others mentioned, and they're better known by the names they're given in Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're not going to compromise. And not just do they sort of hide and tuck away these beliefs and, you know, sort of live them in secret. Man, it is known what these guys are committed to. In fact, it's said of Daniel that these other rulers, because Daniel's been elevated to leadership in Babylon, these other rulers are so envious and so jealous of the favor that he has. It says they plot in how to get him, but they could find no fault in his character, not one flaw in his integrity that they could go after. So what do? They sort of, you know, come in sneakily and say to the king, and most kings have this element of, you know, pride, and they sort of prey on that and say, look, you know, let's pass this new rule that for the next month, you're the most important, you know, person ever. And no one can pray to anyone except you. And no one can call on the name of any other deity except you, O king. And the king sort of goes, well, that's such a nice idea. That's great. Let's do that. Let's enact that. And these other envious rulers go, got him, because they know that Daniel will not compromise what he is convicted of, and that is that he's going to pray 3 times daily facing Jerusalem, believing that his God has still hears him. And so these guys just go and wait, because they know Daniel is going to what? Take action. He's going to engage in what he believes. And so they wait, and as soon as he prays, they arrest him, they drag him to the king, and he's thrown into the lion's den. And most of you will know the rest of the story. If not, read the book of Daniel. It's a phenomenal account. You see, it's not what we talk, it's what we live. You're not going to just be ever convicted in a court because you said you believed something or you felt something. We'll be convicted about what we do, good or evil. Colossians 3:17 and 1 Corinthians 10:31, Paul, the writer of both, says this: whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. Do it for the sake of Christ. Whatever you do. Now, there are instructions about whatever, you know, is good, whatever's right, whatever's pleasing, whatever's of good report, whatever's beautiful. Think on these things. So there's a discipline of the mind, but there is a discipline of the action. Be conformed to the likeness of Christ. Be transformed. Those are action words. It's not just the renewing of a mind. It is the product of the renewed mind. It is the action that takes place. Tonight, as I wrap this up, we've talked first. We looked at this triangle And on this triangle there, were taken from a study by a psychologist, a doctor named Dr. Adler. He talked about our attitude, our transaction with culture, with community that we live in, either for influence or to be influenced, is based around these three things: our beliefs, our feelings, and our actions. And we've been talking about this. This is the third week now. And the thing that we first talked about was when our feelings rule. Now, I'll come to that in just a moment. But the importance of this week is this is where it really comes to a point. This is what I'm really calling the therapeutic practice. This is the remedy. It's not just about, you know, being ruled by our feelings. We're not just run by that. We're not just sort of holding on tenaciously, trying to hold on to belief. There's a part in this that becomes very therapeutic where we take action that gives substance to what we say we believe. Belief just can so easily get entangled in our head, but there is, when we take action in line with what we believe, it gives substance to it. The first week we talked about this sort of next idea that says that there is a time when, you know, our feelings overrule our beliefs and shape our actions for good or for bad. But the graph of that looks more like this next image, that our feelings are just like this overpowering thing. And it's very easy to be run on feelings. Relationships that run on feelings are some of the most tumultuous relationships you'll ever find. We're in love, we're out of love. You know, they're good to me, they're not good to me, you know, and we just run because we're ruled by these feelings and it overpowers our belief. We talked a little bit about the difference between, you know, the limbic system and the, you know, cognitive thinking and the battle that's there, but they call it the reptile part of the brain because sometimes our feelings engage so strongly. And this has been proven with those little, you know, brain mapping things. When this bad boy is firing, this bit where all the rational thought, where all that, you know, linear thinking, it just goes like quiet. And this part of all the feelings is just raging. Anyone ever encountered this sense that the feelings just take over? And it can be good or it can be awful. It's for good or for bad. You can have the happiest times. You can have the saddest times. Man, you can have rage that takes over. And we see in the news all the time where there's this limbic system, rage, and conscious thought goes out. People just smack one another and end up tried for what? One punch kills. It can be good or it can be so destructive. Or we can, you know, there's another good place that's following on from this, that our beliefs overrule our feelings and give shape to our actions. But the reality of that is it's a lot harder. Fewer people are they that are really driven by rational, linear thinking. And when we do meet people like that, a lot of people think, man, they're sort of cold. They're sort of disconnected. They're sort of out of touch with their feelings. Because feeling people, we like to have feeling. And it's not that common to be just ruled by what we believe. But what we believe must have substance. And this is how we create it. It is when we take action over what we feel and give substance to what we believe. Right from the beginning in the Bible, where God sets his people up in the land as they're going across, Joshua says this: choose. You choose. Choice is action. Choose today who you will serve. But for me and my house, we're going to what? Serve the Lord. We're going to take action about what we believe. We are going to serve the Lord. Another action word. It's not we're just going to believe what the Lord has said. No, we're going to engage it. Newton's first law of motion. Those scientific ones amongst us, those who remember physics from school, know that Newton's first law of motion basically says this. that which is at rest will remain at rest until a force is applied to it. What that says is there's this state of potential energy. Anyone remember this from school? Potential energy. That everything has this potential energy. As people, we have this potential energy, but it's not until it's engaged does it become this kinetic energy. And so this first law of motion that Newton put words to is this truth that we as people will remain so often just sedentary. And I believe more and more we just become sedentary until we're moved by some outside force. But the biggest enemy we have is this, the enemy called, I don't feel like it. I don't feel like it. Want to go out? I don't feel like it. Want to exercise? I don't feel like it. Now, for some of us, we're convicted about our need for exercise. Now, for me, I was convicted for a very short window of time this year. I have Shane Horton, who is in my life, and Shane Horton is one of our trainers here, and he just so beautifully words it. He's like, Tim, you're at that age. Thanks, Shane. But it's right. He's like, man, it's the stage of life where if you're not aware of it, like you hit 50 and people start going, oh, you better do something. I look at myself and I'm like, why? Look at this. No, it's like, you know, but there's a reality that there's, you know, blood pressure and all those other things that just happen as we have this body that deteriorates. I love that second law of thermodynamics that says everything is in a constant state of decay. If you don't do something about it, it's going to deteriorate. And so, you know, I decided that I would get in the gym. In fact, I tell myself I go to the gym every day. I do. In fact, I go to the gym every day. I walk through, I say hi to people, how you doing, and walk out the other door. Get a drink, and then go about what I was doing. But Shane, he's like, man, you got to do something. Okay, you know what I'm going to do? Shane goes, just put it on your calendar. So I did. 3 days a week, it's on my calendar. Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Gym. But you know what happens? Every day, the alarm goes off. Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Yeah, I'm not feeling it. Not feeling it. My biggest enemy, it's a reality. I don't feel it. Like there are other people that just do the rational, man, you need it, you got to do it, and they're there and they're doing this thing and I don't feel like it. Action is a decision. It's more than a feeling. It's more than a belief. I will constantly remain in this state of potential energy, feeling like, man, I'm really, really, really feeling it. Man, I should do something. Should. But when it comes to the action, I'm not feeling it kicks in just as quick. It's not about how much I believe it. I wouldn't even have a gym here if I didn't believe in the benefits of it for everyone else. You see, this is the thing. It's like you got to take action that brings substance to that which you say you believe. And it's not just applicable to our, you know, Christian faith. You will find this across every area of life. Action is always a decision. If there's something you can physically do, then do it. But are there things that we should do, but all of a sudden there's this irrational fear? It's funny, when it comes to faith, the enemy loves to play with our little fear button. There's a part we do in our marriage courses where we talk about core fears and how all of us have these core fears that are hidden away in us, but they're triggered. And we try to guard them and protect them so they don't get triggered. But there are also these irrational fears. In Proverbs, it says, the lazy man says, oh, there could be a lion outside and my blood will be shed in the street. It's this laziness that's created by this irrational fear. I struggle with it. When I think about the gym, I'm like, I've seen videos of people get dumped off those treadmill things. Not me. Never going to happen. I've seen people crush their sternums bench pressing. Not me. Never going to happen. I just never exercise. But false fears will keep us from experiencing the fullness of life. Philippians 4:13 is what should always drive us onward. It says, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. When you live according to your faith, you take action based on what you believe, and in turn, it gives substance to it. I was faced with this, funny enough, last Monday morning. Donna and I went out to get a cup of coffee and a bit of breakfast. We went to Alex Surf Club. And, you know, you get those times you just want space. Bless you. We want space. And so we go down there, and I sit at this table, right as this other couple are sitting down. And I said, oh, is there enough space? Do you mind if we sit here? And she's like, no, it's fine. I just want this shady little section. I'm like, that's great. We end up talking for ages, about 45 minutes. And as we get to sort of the point in this story, I find that this guy he's up here on a bit of a holiday. He's got two tumors in his brain, lung cancer. And as soon as he said it, I have this conviction and this belief that what? Man, I should offer to pray for this guy. I believe in the power of prayer because I believe in the God who hears me when I speak to him. And I believe that he answers in accordance to his will. But I got to ask, I believe that. But there's this part that goes, isn't that a little weird? Here we are sitting on the new promenade at Alex Surf Club outside the cafe, and there are people all around drinking coffee and eating their breakfasts, and I've just met these guys and I don't know them. What are they going to think about you? And I am faced with this decision, but I knew in that moment, take action. So with this couple, I said, I'm just sitting there, I'm like, man, I don't know what you believe. I don't know what you even think about prayer, but can I pray for you? Like, pray, you got cancer, man. And he's like, no, I don't do the prayer thing. I got this mantra that I say to myself that you can beat this thing. You know what? The funniest thing happened. I'm not always like this. Well, most of the time I probably am like this, but I just had this visual, because right in front of us, in the middle, there is this umbrella post. And I just reached out and I took a hold of this and I said, you know what? If you were walking right now and you stumbled and you were about to fall and plant your face into the concrete, you would grab at anything there was around you. You would grab a hold of this post here just to stop you smashing your face. But you will resist prayer. I said, this is engaging with a God, I believe, who knows you and he cares about you. And prayer is just really asking him to engage this space. Can I pray for you? And he's like, yeah, you can pray for me. And we end up at this table just praying. But if we have this conviction, where's the action attached to it? What have I got to lose? What, the few people look and go, wonder what they're doing? Well, I'm happy to show you. What do we have to lose? We're so afraid of this irrational fear of losing face in front of people. Feeling weird, feeling strange, being rejected. They're irrational fears. They're the lion outside the door that my blood might get spread in the street. They're irrational. We got to choose to engage that what we believe. And if we take action, it gives a deeper and richer substance to that which we say we believe. And you will grow in conviction, and I believe you will grow in opportunity, and the fruits of that action give an even richer life and experience. And I tell you what, feelings will follow it. I walked away from that pumped. I was like, that was sick. And Donna's like, man, I've never heard you use that analogy before. And I'm like, neither have I. Like that just sort of happened in the moment. I just had this visual, I don't want to do that, grab that. Hey. And it ends up you're praying with someone. It's like, so I'm kind of ready again. I want the next analogy. Or I'll use the same one if I don't come up with something else. But this is applicable across life. Stop letting "I don't feel like it" rule you. Stop letting "I don't feel it." I'm not feeling church. I'm not feeling the presence of God. I talked about looking for that elusive, you know, hotspot Wi-Fi signal that we treat God like. Stop it. Trust Him. That He engages with us. Whenever we turn our hearts to Him, He engages us. You may not feel it, but you can trust it. It's applicable across marriages, those who are married. And by the way, how good was it to see Scotty and Rachel get married yesterday? It was so fun, and I love seeing it in this community, people that meet, engage, and it goes on to do life together. But it's not enough if I just say, I just feel love for my wife. I believe marriage is a good thing. If I don't choose to engage it, if I don't take action. People say, our marriage is stale, not feeling so much love anymore. Well, you know what? My question is, when did you last do something about it? We often want someone to do it for me. No, you choose to do it for someone else again and again and again and again and again. If you're a farmer, in fact, if Will was here, Will Stain could tell us all about ginger farming. But I tell you what, he doesn't till the soil just once. He doesn't just take one action. He tends it and he tends it and he tends it and he tends it until he has a crop. And that's the same thing we got to do in relationships. It's the same thing we must do in our faith. It's the same thing with the things we say we believe. We can shift culture with it. We can shift culture with love. You know what the Bible says? Love one another. And we are trained to believe in our culture that love is attraction, it's arousal, it's sentimentality. It's films, it's movies, it's songs, it's books. There's this sense that love is just this feeling. But over and over, God commands that we love. So here's a little test on emotions. You see, you can't command an emotion. All right, I want everyone here to just feel sad. Okay, change. Stop smiling. I said sad. Well, all right, forget sad. Be afraid. Be terrified, in fact. All right, enough terrified. Be happy. Now, how much was that an emotional roller coaster for everyone in here? It's like me playing with your emotions, right? No, you didn't feel a thing. Because emotions cannot be commanded. They can be manipulated. We can create environments to try and do things to people, but they can't be commanded. I can't stand there and say this. So why does Jesus say again and again, love one another? Because it is a choice to action that we choose to engage. Jesus said this by the Spirit to John in 1 John 3:18. John writes this, let us not merely say that we love each other, but let us show the truth by our actions. Let us show the truth by our actions. Let's give substance to it by our actions. You know, I believe in the people matter thing wholeheartedly. It's become this foundational underpinning of what Good Life is about. People matter. And it's contagious. It's incredible to be outside of these four walls with People Matter. And, you know, people want shirts. Where did you get that sticker? Where'd that shirt come from? And if they came back to the source of that and found that really people don't matter one hoot to us, what is the point? Burn the shirts, cut up the stickers, put them in the bin. Who cares? Because if it's just a slogan, it's worthless. And our lives have to be lives of conviction and action. There's so many principles in the Scriptures, and we'll say, well, I don't feel it. Don't feel like loving. Well, it's not really an option when we're told love. It's a choice to take action. Seek first the kingdom of God. Everything else will be added unto you. Well, I don't feel like seeking God right now. I feel like seeking self. And our natural inclination, driven by feeling, is self. The Bible says, do good But that selfish part goes, but no one does it for me. I'm a survivor. I'm a self-made man. You know what? We got to get out of this self-focused, selfishness. Give and it will be given to you. In good measure, pressed down. But I'll have less. It's funny, the giving thing, we get so caught up in stuff. And we can make giving about everything that God will bless us with if we do it, but it's got nothing to do with that. It's an instruction to us to give as God has given. Forgive, but they don't deserve it. Did we deserve God's forgiveness? Mm-mm. He didn't have this gush of emotion towards us. He made a decision that he would forgive us. Forgiveness is not a gush of emotion based in empathy or compassion. It is a decision that removes the power of unforgiveness and the destructive nature where we hold on to resentment and bitterness. It does not release the responsibility for the action that was taken against us. It removes its power over our lives. And God says, as you forgive, that same measure you will be forgiven. Serve one another. What Sarah was talking about, man, the funniest thing that people say is, oh, I'm not feeling it this season. I'm not going to do kids. I'm not feeling it. I don't care if we feel it or not. It's a decision. People don't pack up boxes at the end of the night. Well, maybe some people do feel like curling a big heavy box, but for the most part, it's because if some of us men don't pick up boxes and move them, we end up with our wives, Jody, with Donna, with some of the girls, with Hannah Bartle and others who at the end of the night will move boxes. There's nothing that gets under my skin more than that. It's because we go, man, we want to serve it. I want to serve this place because tomorrow there'll be kids gathered here. There'll be people exercising here. Tomorrow night there'll be sports here. And if we didn't prepare the way for that to happen, man, we can say we believe people matter, but if we're not willing to serve one another, we completely miss the point. Jesus said this when he washed his disciples' feet in John chapter 13. He says this to him as he put his outer garment back on. He says, do you understand what I've just done for you? You call me teacher and Lord. You call me master. And you're right to do so, he says, for that is who I am. But if I then, your Lord and teacher, have served you, you should also serve one another. If I've washed your feet, you should wash other people's feet. If I've given to you, you should give. If I have forgiven you, you should forgive. As I have given to you, so you in turn should give, is what he's saying. I have given you an example, Jesus said, so that you should do just as I have done for you. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. You hear what Jesus says? He says the blessing isn't in knowing what's right to do. The blessing isn't in feeling it. The blessing is doing it. John 14, if you love me, you'll keep my commands. You'll do what I say. Jesus says, if anyone loves me, he'll keep my word. My Father will love him. He'll see it. He'll come to him. We'll make our home with him. Whoever does not love me doesn't bother to keep my words. And the word that you hear, it's not just mine, it's my Father's who sent me. John 15, if you keep my commandments, you abide in my love, just as I've kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I've told you, that my joy may be in you and your joy may be full. This is my commandment, love one another as I've loved you. You want to know where to start? In the New Testament, there's over 59 references to one another. 15 times it says, love one another. Be at peace with one another. Be devoted to one another. Devoted is an action word. Live in harmony with one another. Greet one another. Greet one another. It's so simple. Acknowledge one another. Smile at one another. Say hi to one another. I'm not feeling it. Then get over yourself. Take action. We can transform the world. Accept one another, encourage one another, pray for one another. I ask, what do we say we believe? What do we say we believe about God's nature and character? Well, He's compassionate, He's kind, He's loving. We went through this last week. But what are we doing about it? What are my actions relating to my faith? How do I respond? Do I do what I can get away with? Do I do what's required? Or I do whatever I can? What are the actions we take? I just take what actions I can get away with. Occasionally I'll let someone see me do a good deed so at least they know I'm in. Or we do what's required. Or do we do whatever we can over and above? I was stoked this morning, actually with Daniel and was it Ryan Puck behind you in the little side street? I'm leaving. I've just finished preaching this. These guys are in the service. And I go to turn up Royal Palm Drive and I see Daniel and he's just loading this family into his car. And I pull over. I'm like, you all right? He's like, oh, yeah, you know, I couldn't leave them walking, could I? You know, and they weren't all fitting in the car. So they load them in Ryan's car and they drive this family home who I don't know where they were walking from. But we have a choice. Do we just drive by them? Hey, good to see you. Good life this morning. In James 4, 13 through 17, it says this, listen, you who say, today, tomorrow, we will go to this city or that city, make great plans, spend a year there, carry out business, make money. You don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What's your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, we ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we'll live and do this or do that. But you make these arrogant schemes. Verse 17 of James 4, if anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, that's sin. That's what it's written in James. That's like this, whoa, really? It's what the, you know, old church fathers would call sins of omission. We're so careful about sins of commission, committing a sin, doing something bad. But it's the sins of omission that are just as bad. We say, be warm, be well fed. Go, be safe, and push people out into the night. It's action. I want to read you this, and we're going to go into communion. And this was originally aired on a radio show just last year in June. But this radio host came across a story and he wanted to get to the bottom of it. And he actually found a lady, now 82 years old, who was involved in this. Interviewed her. You can listen to it. During World War II, when Japan occupied China, they built concentration camps that were filled with American, British, other European civilians. Civilians who'd been living in China. One of those camps was called Waising. Among the inmates were a group of children. They were American and British mainly, were mostly kids of missionaries. They'd been studying at a boarding school named Chifu. Japanese troops invaded Chifu and captured the kids and eventually brought them to this concentration camp. With their teachers, but no parents, about 150 children who were in this camp for 4 years, with the teachers who had sensibly taken with them books, paper, musical instruments, and of course, one more thing, their girl guide uniforms or their brownie uniforms. Of all the things they thought, we're going to need this sort of things to keep the kids occupied. A logbook was found in the concentration camp, and it was the record kept by one of the girl guide leaders. Leaders were called brown owls. And this one was a woman in her 20s. 20s. That's so many of us in this room. Well, not us, but so many of you in this room. But according to the logbook, this girl, the brown owl, ran the troop as if it were any other girl guide unit, concentration camp or not. They were all told, it doesn't matter how disgusting the food is, we still want good table manners. It doesn't matter how hungry you are, you will not steal. You are still going to do a good deed every day, and you are going to help other people. Obviously, the grim sadness of life in the concentration camp should have overpowered this miniature world that the brown owl leaders were trying to build for their young girls. But according to this girl, Janie, that's not what happened. Instead, it was the girl guides who started to exert an influence on the adults around them, and they led by example, and they changed the tone of a concentration camp. It made all the difference to the adults in the camp, and it kept them going. The whole atmosphere was better because they'd made this very strong promise that they wouldn't stop smiling. It's a simple value of the Girl Guide Order that you smile. So they chose in this toxic environment to smile. They wouldn't give up. They would carry on singing songs. They would insist that everybody was washing. And there's a story about the brown owls insisting on good table manners, and it comes from this lady they interviewed named Mary Previte, who at the time was of the interview is 82. So just last year, she's 82, and I actually listened to just a glimpse of that. Ryan can give you the link. It's amazing listening to this lady. She sounds like she's so joyous. She says this, so you're eating some glop out of maybe boiled animal grain or something, and you're eating it out of a soap dish or a tin can, and here comes Mrs. Stark up behind us, one of the teachers. Mary Taylor, do you slouch over your food while you're eating? Don't talk while you have food in your mouth. There's not two sets of manners, one set of manners for the princess in Buckingham Palace and another set of manners for the Wysine concentration camp. The leaders led the children in the traditional Girl Guide practice of singing. They said it was like you weren't going to be afraid if you could sing about it. We would sing. And it's funny when you listen to this interview, this old lady, 82, still singing the songs of a concentration camp. She said, day is done, gone the sun from the sea, from the hills, from the sky. All is well, safely rest. God is nigh. How could you be afraid when you were singing about all is well, safely rest, God is nigh? How can you be afraid after that? And Mary said this, one of the things that we sang when the Japanese were marching us into concentration camp, 12 years old, was the first verse of Psalm 46. And again, she sings it on the interview. God is our refuge, our strength. It goes on, in trouble, we'll not be afraid. All of these words just sung in our hearts, Mary says. That sticks. It's like you've got a groove sticking in the old gramophone record. I'm safe, I'm safe, I'm safe. It was profound. And there probably aren't many places on earth where you'd have less reason to be cheerful than a concentration camp. But it turns out that in a place like that, being able to be cheerful, to have a positive outlook, it wasn't dopey or silly. It's how you survive. Listen to the last thing that said. How you tell the story matters. How you tell the story. What's our life say? Not just talk about what we believe. What's our life say? They warded off despair for 4 years until August 17th, 1945, they were rescued. Struck me. It's how you tell the story that matters. It's not about just how we feel, that last visual there. Feelings are not the evil thing, I said that last week. But the attitude that we will have in the society that we find ourselves in, whether it's the Sunshine Coast or the equivalent of Babylon, will be shaped by the action that we take in the beliefs that we have, that give substance to the beliefs we have and get our feelings in order. I tell you again, my wife is not moved by what I believe about marriage or about how I feel inside if I never show it. It would mean nothing. You might feel compassion for kids. You might believe that kids should be taught, they should be cared about. But when you see Sarah, put your head down and run. Because we talk it all up. You might believe giving is a good value and see need or emotion, but do what about it? Scriptures say we've got to be doers of the word, not hearers only. And then that whole thing happens from that potential energy. There's this force, the Spirit of God begins to like move, and it turns into this kinetic energy, and we begin to put practice that gives substance to what we believe, that in turn empowers what we believe over what we feel, and it shapes our actions, and we choose more action as it comes to life. And the church becomes the agent that changes the feeling, the sense, the whole tone of culture. If we will do it. I said in the second service this morning, and I know it'll tick people off, but we would be just as effective in this community of Good Life if half the people got mad and left, because they're not engaged anyway. I'm not about just attending stuff. I want to change the world. I want to shift culture. I want to see people move. Jesus began a movement. It's an unstoppable force. The kingdom of God will advance. The Bible says it's an ever-advancing kingdom. The choice, the invitation to all of us is to engage it, to be it, to do it. Where would we be if God just felt pity? Where would we be? God, enthroned in the heavens, looks at humanity and goes, "Oh, poor wretches. Look what they've done to their world. Look at what they've wasted of everything I gave them. Look at the sin that racks them. Look at the death sentence that hangs over them. Oh, how I pity them." Well, what would be accomplished if God, enthroned in heaven, says, "Oh, I believe in their worth. Oh, I believe that I created them upright and good. I created them in righteousness. Oh, I believe their value. They're my image bearers." And did nothing. But God so loved the world that He gave His Son to enter into our brokenness and to take upon Himself the sin of the world, that we could be in turn liberated, to take action in His name, on His behalf, empowered by His Spirit, to continue to transform the world we are in. And the question for us is, what are we going to do? Feel pity for the world we live in? Believe that the kingdom of God's an advancing kingdom? Or are we going to get off our behind and do something? When we were powerless to overcome sin, He entered this world and became sin. He took it to the cross upon Himself to end the power that it had over us. And as we come to this communion table tonight, do we just come out of tradition believing that Jesus did something? Are we moved by the emotion of it? The night that Jesus was betrayed, the emotion that there with His friends He took bread and He broke it, that He took a cup and He shared it. Are we somehow moved by that? Or do we, in an action, extend our hand to that and say, "I want Jesus to be engaged in everything that You're about. Not just my forgiveness of sin, but me being conformed to Your likeness, that I become an agent of Your grace, of Your mercy, of Your goodness, of Your righteousness, of Your faithfulness." And so as we come tonight, ask yourself the question, genuinely, if you come to break bread and take a cup, ask yourself why. Why am I doing it? Am I doing it because it's one of those things you do as a Christian? No. unless you're engaged in it, don't do it. Allow that action to actually give substance. Take it going, God, I want to be about what you are about. This is my action of engagement. And then come. Unless you take it. Thank God for His grace. Thank God for His forgiveness. But ask Him by His Spirit to move you to be an agent of His kingdom advancing. It's so powerful. It is so beautiful. It is so liberating. It's so purpose-giving. And you will find as you do it that there's joy. Like, I don't just, you know, grab people, but I tell you, and not to embarrass you, but Ben, I love the transformation work of Jesus in your life. I love that you can't take a smile off your face when you actually talk about Him. I love that you've become this vehicle and this vessel of God's kingdom advancing. And it's not some fake thing that we do, like, and it's not some crazed grin we get. But there's this actual ownership of that kingdom work in me that I want to, in turn, when we get it, man, we want to be it. Doesn't mean you'll never go through darkness, discouragement, trial. We will. I go through really dark times sometimes. I have friends that I talk with about it. But then I choose to take action, to engage what I say I believe and give life to it and overcome those feelings. So as you come, ask God again, have your way in me. Have your way in my surrender. Have your way in my engagement. Have your way in me. Come as you want to. Break bread. Take a cup. Engage Christ by choice.